Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, it's all about fruit, really.
It is.
And in a fabulous way.
I know, it's a good way.
It is a good way. We're going to get an update from the folks at Kentucky State University on their pawpaw research and also some blackberry research. But we spoke to Kurt Pomper a couple of years ago on, you know, trying to get the pawpaw to hit the scene in a little bit more significant way for people. So Sherry's going to join us and see what kind of progress they've made on basically making the shelf life a little bit longer.
Yeah, it's about 20 minutes.
It is about 20 minutes.
But blackberries, and every time we do these kind of shows, I make myself a liar. I hear these shows, I talk to people. I want to get out there and do it, and I'm about 6 plants behind already, and it's only, middle of April?
I know, no kidding.
But stay tuned, folks, because you'll learn a lot about pawpaws and blackberries.
And a bunch of other fruit, too. We're going to talk to Lee Reich. He's recently put out a book called Landscaping with Fruit. He likes his unusual fruit. A couple years ago, we interviewed him after his Uncommon Fruit for Every Garden book came out. And I mean, honestly, it's like some of the stuff that's in the book, I didn't know that I could eat. I mean, I've got it, but I don't know. I didn't know that I could eat it, so I'm excited. Plus, there's some other things that I think I might have to try this year. So if you're interested in that whole sort of backyard, turning it into something that's a little bit more sustainable and ecologically sound and something that you can enjoy visually but also eating, this is definitely the show for you.
Yeah, not just a row of trees, but different shrubs and trees and bushes, all edible in their season. In theory and in fact, you could have a different fruit out there.
That's right.
From May until October.
And Bob said it, it's in its season. You can have something interesting all the time. So we hope that you'll stick with us today. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Speaking of being in season, I've always liked the little girl magnolias, the Jane and the Betty and so forth. If you have a small yard and like magnolias, a little courtyard or a patio yard, it's just a great plant to have. Mine are just were just fabulous.
We were talking about them just the other day, Andy and I, about what a good, nice ornamental
easy to
tree
grow,
that is.
Yeah. Jane. And the other thing, I want a resurgence of the forsythia, which is considered kind of a weed, I think, in some areas. But I want to talk to an expert. We'll get him on the show maybe. About different cultivars of forsythia, which kind of blooms real early and is forgotten. But I think there's other ones out there.
I don't think there are.
Yes, there are. You're a hater.
I think we did that already like 5 years ago, and like there were only two varieties.
Well, there's
to
more.
Choose from.
I read these catalogs. You're
good.
A forsythia hater, I can tell.
No, I'm not. Because I think that
there's a place for them in the landscape.
Absolutely. I think they're fabulous plants. The problem is that people don't prune them properly.
Well,
and they butcher them.
That's what we're here for.
Yeah. So, exactly.
We're here for. But go forsythia. I'm advocating forsythia in every yard.
I love them. I think
properly
they're
great. Placed,
and
bright
properly
spring
pruned.
Colors. You got me up in my high chair now, kiddo. What's going on in the Wishy Estate, by the way?
Oh, gosh. The forsythia is definitely blooming and looking really pretty.
Okay.
The ones that we take care of
both
actually
of
look good.
Okay.
No, we've got quite a few, in fact.
Right.
When you got 20 acres, you can have quite a few of about everything. But I keep getting questions from people about fertilizing their lawn and those little mailers that you get in the mail about, we looked at your lawn. I know they didn't look at my lawn because it's a big old field. But we looked at your lawn and this is how much it'll cost for us to spray chemicals all over it to keep the weeds out and to fertilize it in the spring, summer, and fall. And Bob, I literally live in the middle of a field, right?
Yes, ma'am.
My grass is beautiful and green and quite healthy enough looking. I mean, really. And I don't put a bunch of fertilizer on it really any time of the year. But honestly, people, we mow our grass, the grass grows faster, rather, I should say, during the month of April than any other month.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you fertilize your lawn to make it grow faster?
You get talked into it.
Exactly. So I want to talk you out of it.
Right.
And if you feel like you really do, for legitimate reasons, need to fertilize your lawn, just hold off until May when things have slowed down a little bit. Because basically, if you do it now, it's going to eat up that fertilizer just with rapid top growth. And it's not really going to, do any benefit.
What about the pre-emergence, the stuff with the fertilizer and the weed kill together in one package?
Right. And I don't like those either because pre-emergent now, yes. But fertilization now, no.
You're fighting each other.
Exactly. So you want to buy them separate.
It's counterproductive.
It is counterproductive. Absolutely. You're right. So if you can, pre-emergent now, and then just wait until the fall of the year to fertilize.
Now, do you fertilize your forsythia this time of year?
Yes. In fact, okay. You can. But I don't do that either.
I know. What a fraud you are.
All right. Oh, well, you know, I'm all for mulching with manure instead, and that's a constant fertilization.
Yes, ma'am, I know.
All right, on to other things that are educational opportunities this spring. I think the gardening event season has begun because we have quite a few events.
Yeah, the Cincinnati Flower Show is back April 18th to 25th at Sims Township Park in Cincinnati. It's one of the best shows in the Midwest.
Yeah, but it is a new location, so note that new location.
Exactly.
But it's a great show.
The 46th Annual Plant Sale and Art in the Garden Show at Farmington Historic Home, Saturday, April 18th and Sunday, April 19th. And also, the Southern Indiana Botanical Society is having a wildflower walk and pitch-in Sunday, April 19th at Charlestown State Park. A good group. Go walk with them.
Uh-huh. And out in Shelby County, the Shelbyville Garden and Art Fair from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, April 25th. It's at the Shelby County Fairgrounds Pavilion. You'll see that right in the middle of a town as you drive in. And then out at Country Corner Greenhouse, which is in Shepherdsville, I'm going to be hanging out with the good folks there Saturday, April 18th at 10:30. So if you're in the area, come by and see us.
Details of all these things, of course, are on our website. So look them up and you'll know exactly the times and the places and the addresses.
That's right, wfpl.org. All right, pawpaws and blackberries. It's definitely the season to look towards planting some new things in the garden, and we've got some ideas for you today. First, with Sherry Crabtree.
Sherry has one of the great jobs in probably North America. She's a research assistant and co-investigator of horticulture at Kentucky State University, where two of the plants most heavily under her microscope have been pawpaws and blackberries. She's with us today to catch up on the pawpaw research in Kentucky and tell us what's going on with the new blackberries. Sherry, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've had the director of the program, Dr. Kirk Pomper, on the show just because you like to say Pomper and Pawpaw in the same sense.
Right, yeah. Yeah, you can call him Dr. Pawpaw.
You can. I
well,
well, let's catch up. A lot of people only know about pawpaws in theory, so let's talk about the pawpaw in fact. What's it look like and what's it do?
Okay, the pawpaw is native to most of the eastern U.S., and another common name for it is the Kentucky banana or the Hoosier banana, depending on if you're from Kentucky or Indiana.
Right.
And part of the reason it gets that name is because the fruit are in a cluster similar to bananas, mm-hmm. although kind of a shorter, rounder fruit than a banana, and green in color, so it really only resembles banana in that it's in a cluster. It also has a somewhat banana-like flavor. It's a really unique tropical flavor. If you've never tasted it before, it's kind of a blend of mango, banana, and pineapple.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's really unique because pawpaw is the only temperate member of the otherwise tropical family. The other members of the family are custard apple, cherimoya, soursop, fruits like that only grow in the tropics, so that's why it has a lot of the tropical characteristics to its flavor.
So, Sherry, this the fruit, at least, and the tree, as you said, native to the southeast, but this was a tree that people used to really know and harvest the fruit, eat the fruit, you know, fresh. Mm-hmm. How come it's one of those trees that's, you know, I hate to say fallen out of favor, but people just aren't as tuned into the fabulousness of it all.
I know. Yeah, it's never really taken off. It's interesting. There was a lot of interest in it at the beginning of the 1900s, in the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
They had several contests looking for the best-tasting pawpaw in the country, and there were a lot of new cultivars being selected and released. But it's interesting because blueberry was kind of in the beginning of commercialization at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, blueberry has taken off and become huge.
Right.
And really the key, we think, is perishability.
Okay.
We were talking about that. Pawpaw has a really short shelf life, so you just can't pick it and store it and ship it, as well as other fruits. They bruise really easily. When they're ripe, they only have like a 3 to 4 day shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
You can pick them slightly underripe and store them in the refrigerator for a couple of weeks. And they'll still have pretty good fruit quality, not quite as good as tree ripened, of course, but that's one way to get around that, but they're still easily bruised and highly perishable.
Yeah, my problem is the raccoons beat me to it by one day every year.
I know, yeah, when they get ripe, yeah, the raccoons and possums.
They line up out there.
So that's something that you guys are starting to focus your research on now at Kentucky State. But let's talk a little bit about the history of the research first. You know, what led to you all taking a look at the pawpaw in a little more serious way?
Okay, well, we are the only full-time research program focusing on pawpaw, so we're unique in that aspect. We've actually had pawpaw research program going on at KSU since 1990. It started with Brett Calloway. We've done a lot of research since then. We have a regional variety trial that started in 1998, looking at 28 different cultivars and advanced selections of pawpaw. Right now we're looking for new potential cultivars, you know, that have good qualities, like we were talking about, good storage ability and post-harvest handling ability. Looking for, you know, these trees that have the really large, nice, good-tasting fruit.
Dr. Popper mentioned when we talked to him there was some cultivars, Overlease, Sunflower, NC1, Shenandoah, and Susquehanna that all were on the market and pretty good pawpaws.
Yes.
But each one would require a male in the neighborhood, right?
Well, there are not male and female in the same tree. They do require cross-pollination.
Right.
You have to have another tree that's genetically different. Although there are male and female parts in the same flower, so it's not male and female trees, but they do need to cross-pollinate. So ideally, you'd like to have at least two cultivars, you know, possibly three, to you know, get the timing of the flowering just right and have good pollination. But those are some of the varieties. You know, we kind of wrapped up our regional variety trial looking at the 28 different selections.
Sherry, does that mean that if I wanted to add some pawpaws to the collection, it would be best that, you know, just picking out of those recommended cultivars for our area to get, you know, one Overlease, one Shenandoah, and one Susquehanna so that the three of them can cross-pollinate, thus I would have a larger yield.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
But do you need a male of each one? Or
no, they've got it on the same plant. It just needs a cross-pollination with another plant.
Right, yeah. Gotcha. They're not self-fertile. But there are male and female parts in the same flower.
So you don't need a guy around, huh?
Just another couple.
Yeah.
That's the way we can... They're swingers. We can say that the pawpaw's a swinger.
Exactly. Well, let's jump over to blackberries now, because I know that's an exciting research area that Janine, her mouth waters when we talk about blackberries.
I love my blackberries. So
what's going on with Kentucky State and blackberries?
Well, we are evaluating some new selections from the University of Arkansas breeding program, and we're growing them using organic standards. So we're looking at organic blackberry production of these new selections from Arkansas. Arkansas has put out a lot of the popular varieties, the whole Native American named series, you know, Navajo and Arapaho.
Right.
And,
those are the ones that we have.
All of those, yeah, came out of Arkansas. So we're kind of looking at the new generation. One of the most interesting things we're looking at right now is primacane fruiting blackberries.
Okay, that first season of growth will fruit.
Right, they will fruit on the first year's cane. Most blackberries will only produce fruit on the second year's cane. And so these will produce on the first year's cane. And so you'll get a fall crop on that first year cane.
Mm-hmm.
They'll start fruiting about in July and go through frost.
Okay.
And
Well,
they
fruit.
They also have a summer crop on the second year.
Okay, so they'll do their second year fruiting as well.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, they'll do that. Although a lot of people like to mow them down in the spring and only get a fall crop.
Mm-hmm. Sort of like you could do with raspberries.
Right, yeah, similar to the fall fruiting raspberries. Yeah, you'll get a larger fall crop if you mow them down in the spring and only have one crop per year. Right now, there's only two of those. They're commercially available. Prime Jim and Prime Jan.
Okay.
Those are both okay for home use. Jan is really the one that we recommend. Jim has, a little bit more bitterness to the fruit. And Jan is a little bit larger fruit and sweeter. But they are going to be releasing some in the near future that will be even better than Jan.
Mm-hmm. So, Sherry, do you think that particularly since you guys are doing organic cultivation of them, that the Primacane is sort of the answer because you'll have less disease incidents and all that because you can cut them back everything
yeah.
can be, you know, kind of excluded each year and let the new stuff grow back? Is that going to be one of the keys?
Exactly, yeah. That's a big part of why they're good for organic production because, yeah, when you mow them down in the spring, you're destroying, you know, a lot of pathogens over winter in the leaf litter or in the canes.
Mm-hmm.
So you're destroying all of that. So that eliminates a lot of the disease and insects that may be overwintering and be harbored in your plant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Sherry, give me a sense of what this looks like. I mean, if I come over to Frankfort and wandered around your blackberry patches at Kentucky State, what would I see?
Well, it's about an acre. We've got quite a few different selections of Primacane fruiting and some Floracane fruiting selections. The Primacane fruiting are more upright, so they don't have to be trellised. Some of the Floracane fruiting selections are semi-trailing, and so we have them on a trellis.
Okay, another advantage to the Primacane, huh?
Right.
Do you all have all your pawpaws on that site as well, or do you have them scattered throughout your different research sites?
They're all on the same site. So
okay.
We've got over 10 acres of pawpaws,
mm-hmm.
and then over an acre of blackberries.
All right.
Now, some of this is an alternative, like to tobacco. Is it based, you know, finding something else Kentucky farmers can grow?
Yes. A lot of farmers that, you know, originally grew tobacco are looking for new alternative crops. And, yeah, they really need a high-value crop to take the place of tobacco, you know, if you want to get anywhere close to the same return per acre
mm-hmm.
of tobacco. So, yeah, these are unique crops that, you know, are high-value. Since they're unique, you know, you can get a pretty good return on them. So, you know, they're well-suited for Kentucky because they're native here. You can grow both pawpaws and blackberries organically.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, they're a really good kind of unique niche crop.
Have there been any farmers that have picked up the blackberry as their alternative crop and made a go at it? As of yet?
There are several blackberry growers in Kentucky. I'm not sure if they're former
mm-hmm.
tobacco growers,
mm-hmm.
but I know there's quite a few people growing blackberries in Kentucky. I couldn't give you a number.
Okay.
I know more about the pawpaw growers. We have
uh-huh.
probably about 5 pawpaw growers. You know, it's still new, but we have about 5 pawpaw growers, maybe
mm-hmm.
15 acres total, which is not a lot, but they're doing well selling at farmers markets and at local, like at Paul's Fruit Market last year
mm-hmm.
there in Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
One of our pawpaw growers was selling some fruit there.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a small window, really, to 2 weeks maybe to sell it.
It is. That's the problem.
Well, it also begs the question, too, doesn't it? Are there ways in which to turn it into the value-added product, you know, when it's
right.
ripe, when it's ready to go, turn it into something else,
mm-hmm.
You know, like we would do with blackberries or blueberries,
right.
we turn it into jam. Is there a place for the pawpaw on the pantry shelf as well?
Definitely, definitely. You can make, yeah, jams, chutneys, relishes out of pawpaw.
Mm-hmm.
And also pawpaw ice cream is one of the most popular things that we make.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes a really, really good ice cream.
Yeah, we know about blackberry jams, of course, and a million other uses. Now, if I was a homeowner listening to this show, wanted to start with some blackberries in my backyard, what cultivar would I get and how would I do it?
Well, if you were looking at the Floracane fruiting blackberries, the summer fruiting blackberries.
Mm-hmm.
Natchez is a new cultivar that is really good. Has really large fruit. They were almost afraid that the fruit size was too big.
Impossible.
Afraid that consumer. Well, yeah, I like the large fruit. They were afraid, you know, consumers might see, you know, these pint containers with, you know, not very many blackberries
two,
in them.
Two
blackberries. They're only getting 20 blackberries in a whole quart. So that's a good new cultivar on the market. Came out of the University of Arkansas. Triple Crown is kind of an old favorite, but
mm-hmm.
it's thornless and has really, really nice sweet berries. Chickasaw is another good one for Kentucky. Produces large fruit, and it's really sweet, has a good flavor. It is thorny, though. That
okay.
one's quite thorny.
Yeah, I like the thornless varieties for sure.
Yeah, they're a lot easier to pick.
Uh-huh. And, so recommended spring planting for your new blackberry patch, yes?
Yes, yeah,
okay.
It's better so you don't have to get them through that first winter, you know, just in case you might have some dieback.
Any particular soil requirements?
You know, blackberries are pretty hardy and pretty vigorous. So, mm-hmm. I mean, they do prefer a soil that's high in organic matter that, you know, keep it moist. You may need to irrigate it, mm-hmm. but also well-drained. You know,
okay,
they
sure.
like a soggy, wet soil. They're not extremely particular. You know, blackberries are pretty trouble-free.
How much space is required, and do they sucker quite a bit, or is it you're fighting them all the time?
Well, blackberries do not sucker as much as raspberries. They do tip root, so, you know, if you have these long trailing types that are falling over, you may get some tip rooting and some shoots coming up from that.
Mm-hmm.
We only put about 2 to 3 feet between blackberry plants,
oh.
and they'll kind of grow together in a hedge that way, if you wanted to keep your variety separate. We'll have, like, blocks of five and only have 2 feet between those, right. but then we'll have 5 feet between blocks to separate the variety. So mm-hmm. if you wanted to keep variety separate, then you'd want to do about 5 feet between them. But just going for kind of a hedge of blackberries, then 2 to 3 feet is good.
Mm-hmm. Works for me.
All right. Yeah. Any fertilization requirements, timing, and then what about pruning, so people kind of know what they need to do to keep their blackberry crop healthy?
Well, we fertilize in the spring.
Okay.
We actually use an organic fertilizer. It's a combination feather, bone, and blood meal.
Okay.
But, you know, you could use any type of fertilizer you want. Anything, you know, it's fairly high in nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
The like, and we do that fairly early in the spring, usually in March or April. They do like to have some nitrogen. And also, after they fruited on the second year's canes,
mm-hmm.
you need to remove those.
Because okay.
those are dead, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
Remove the canes after the second year that have died. And you can, to keep them from getting too tall and to promote branching, you can do a tipping of them, you know, kind of a heading cut.
Mm-hmm.
Once they get to be about a meter tall, you can go through and prune them. This is on the fall fruiting blackberries.
All right. Sounds good.
Well, Sherry, thank you. Sounds like a job with some side and top benefits.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah.
To be enjoyed by everybody.
Yeah, we enjoy all the benefits, eating all the fruit.
Okay.
Take a little bit home with us.
All right. Thank you so much, Sherry.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot. Uh-huh.
Sherry Crabtree is a research assistant and co-investigator of horticulture at Kentucky State University, where she's been studying pawpaws and blackberries. For more information on Sherry, how to get information about the pawpaw and blackberry research, or Kentucky State University, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Let your landscape earn its keep. Lee Reich joins us after the break. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And we're going to continue the conversation about backyard fruit enthusiasts, but a little bit of a different vein, perhaps ideas to help you actually landscape a yeah. nice design with fruit. You know, so often people just line out, you know, and myself included,
yeah, right.
you know, back in the garden, I've got lines of blueberry bushes, I've got lines of blackberries, lines of raspberries, but you can really mix it up in a more creative design.
Yeah, incorporate them in the landscape, like mm-hmm. the blueberries in the fall, a beautiful leaf color.
Absolutely, they really
and you can
are.
Go out, if you can beat the birds to the blueberries, you can
yeah.
keep them closer to the house.
And you can, mostly.
So it's a great idea.
It is a great idea, and Lee Reich has had that idea and has put it into a book. Lee's joining us today. Lee has a PhD in horticulture from the University of Maryland and is a consultant and author of several books, including Weedless Gardening, Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden, and the most recent Landscaping with Fruit, A Homeowner's Guide, which is published by Story Press. Lee, welcome to Homegrown and thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Great. Listen, you place yourself somewhere between farmer and gardener. Can you first tell us about your own garden in New York and your gardening philosophy?
Okay. First of all, the term I'm trying to put into the English language is farm-dener.
Farm-dener.
More than a garden, less than a farm.
Oh.
Farm-dener, okay.
It actually started out as a garden. I had a house with 3/4 acre around it.
Mm-hmm.
But then the field just to the south, which was only another acre and a half, became available. So I
Uh-oh.
Started cultivating that too.
Okay.
Do that intensely puts me in the category of, as I say, more than what one person can take care of sanely.
Right. I think that's me as well.
You'll be in Schenectady pretty soon. Just keep buying the lot next door, man.
So give us your best sell, I guess, on why fruit in the landscape is the way to go, and then we can talk about details.
Uh-huh. Well, surely, you know, if you have a small lot or even a large lot, you know, people often think about, well, you know, I'm going to find, you know, I want to make my yard look nicer, so I'll plant some ornamental trees, and then they sort of think, well, you know, it'd be nice to have some edible plants too, especially nowadays when people are more concerned with, you know, tainted food and more people want to grow things organically. So a number of years ago, this is about 20 years ago, I started thinking about why not just combine the two into plants that are both beautiful and edible.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I've been doing and promoting and writing about is using fruiting plants as landscape plants.
Mm-hmm.
But this means more than just, you know, you take a fruit plant and stick it in the ground that's a landscape plant where you would have planted, say, a maple tree, because not all fruiting plants are nice landscape plants. And the other thing is that fruiting plants, some fruit plants in some places, have pest problems.
Sure.
And you don't want to be spraying. You know, most people, when they plant, say, a forsythia bush, they're not planning to, they'll prune it a little, but they're not planning to really take a lot of time with pest control.
Mm-hmm.
So you want that same standard in a fruiting plant that you use in the landscape. In addition, you don't want to be spraying a plant that, if you were going to spray, you know, that's near a terrace or that's maybe near where your children play. So the purpose of my book was really to really focus on plants, you know, region by region, plants that both look nice for a long time, taste truly good,
mm-hmm.
and that rules out certain plants that have edible fruits, but I don't consider that they taste that good. And this isn't survival gardening.
Yeah.
and ones that are low maintenance.
Right.
Preferably no pruning, no pests, beautiful as long as possible, and taste great.
That's a pretty tall order.
Right. And there are some plants that come close or mm-hmm. actually meet that standard, and some, you know, require a little pruning. You know, maybe some aren't beautiful from January to December, but
right.
they're beautiful for 6 months of the year.
Sure.
Lee, it's an idea that makes much great sense. You wonder why it hasn't been tried before. What's just farm over here, yard over here? What's been the mentality been that prevented this over time, over history?
I think just because people are very traditional, especially when it comes to gardening and agriculture, and what's been done for the last 2,000 years is still done.
Mm-hmm. And I think too, we're moving back towards it to be sure, but we've moved away from growing our own food
right.
and appreciating the bounty that comes from certain plants, and just looking at them as specimens in the landscape, not useful. So let's set up some scenarios, Lee. Let's plan a landscape for Kentuckiana, you know, hardiness zone 6.
Yeah.
We have humid summers, of course.
Right.
So what are some of the considerations when planning this sort of edible mixed garden?
Well, the first there's all sorts of ways to approach the considerations. One is, you know, from a landscape standpoint, I think an important consideration of I have a little section in my book, it's called the psychoanalysis section.
Yeah.
And this is the one where you sit down, you really evaluate, you lie down on a couch, and then you ask yourself questions.
Sure.
You know, how much time do you want to spend working with your plants? How much expertise do you want to gain learning about your plants? What kind of fruits do you like to eat?
Mm-hmm.
And when are you going to be available in the garden? For instance, if your whole family takes a trip, right after school lets out, don't plant June berries because that's when they ripen. Right.
Yeah, that's good thinking, actually.
Uh-huh. And then, you know, and when I said how much time, you know, you're willing to spend, that's important because you can choose, depending on the care you're willing to spend on a plant, there are plants that virtually no care and some plants that are high maintenance. So you just choose accordingly.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about a little bit of both, I guess. Somebody who's interested in a reasonable amount of time to spend with these plants, you know, a little pruning here or there, a little cleanup here or there, harvesting, that sort of thing. Give us some interesting ideas that would work for gardeners here.
Well, do you mean just plants?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Well,
let's highlight some plants.
Well, the plant that was mentioned a few minutes ago, a blueberry,
uh-huh.
I would say for most of the country, truly down there in Kentucky, if there was one plant that I would recommend, it's blueberry.
Mm-hmm.
It's it's pretty practically year-round. With good care, it's practically pest-free. So that's one. But there's a lot of other plants. Another one that's native down there, which is quite a beautiful plant and quite a tasty fruit, is pawpaw.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. There's also, if you want a ground cover, a nice ground cover is lowbush blueberry, lingonberries.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much any quality you look for in a landscape plant, you can also find in a fruiting plant.
Yeah, Leo, I was a little worried about one of these, particularly like the Russian olive, which I have some experience with. It was pretty invasive for me. It suckered quite a bit.
I had some friends who do research in invasive plants, and they were trying to twist my arm to take it out of the book. But are you sure you're talking about Russian olive and not autumn olive?
No, it was Russian olive, and it just it suckered and spread. But, I think if you took some time and took care of it, it's a beautiful bush. The picture
and
in the book is very nice.
It can be trained to a tree form. It's a beautiful tree.
Right. Yeah.
So what's the fruit like?
The fruit is edible and actually pretty good, but it's not a great tasting.
Mm-hmm.
It actually, in Western Asia, they eat it. And what they do is they let it dry out on the plant, which would be hard to do in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that dry there. But when it does dry out on the even in Kentucky when it's dead ripe, it sort of has a sweetish flavor. When it dries out, the skin becomes sort of hardened like parchment, and then inside it's almost like this very sweet talcum powder interior. Mm-hmm. It's quite interesting.
Now you mentioned one of my favorite long neglected tough hard stubborn trees, the hackberry.
Yeah.
I've never had a hackberry in my life, but it's really a great functional tree. Talk about the fruit of that one.
Yeah, that's another one that was true personal opinion because I happen to love that tree.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the fruit, first I'll talk about the tree. One of my favorite things about the tree as far as its ornamental aspects is the bark.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not something I'll knock you over, but if you stop and look at it, especially on a winter day when the sun's low in the sky and creates these shadows, it's really, to me, it's beautiful. The fruit itself is pea-size.
Yeah, small.
It's pea-size with a very large single seed. There's not much flesh there. But, but what flesh there is tastes almost like a date.
Huh.
So sweet.
Lee, I've got two fabulous hackberries on my property, and my dog eats the hackberries ripe, when they fall on the driveway. And then the chickens like the ones back by the barn.
Uh-huh.
So I will definitely... I was never really sure if they were safe for me to eat.
It's a good
nibble.
So I
will this year for sure.
It's not something you're going to be chomping into, but
right.
It's a nice nibble.
Huh. I need a big ladder for mine. It's about 60
and it's also nice because the tree is related to the American elm,
mm-hmm.
but does not, of course, get Dutch elm disease.
Yeah.
So it has a really nice shape to it. It has a nice vase-shaped growth habit.
It's way underused. Huh. How about specimen trees in containers that you can also eat the fruit from?
Oh, yeah. For Kentucky, of course, if you're in California, you can grow just about anything. But one thing that I like to suggest, if somebody has the inclination to take care of these containers and move them indoors, is some very ornamental subtropical plants that you can grow. And this would include, a lot of people do this anyway, fig trees,
right.
which are subtropical. They can take temperatures down to about 15 degrees, but then they need to be protected in the winter, at which time they don't need any light. Another nice one is a pomegranate, which is quite nice. And then one of my favorites, which not too many people have heard of, is a pineapple guava. It's actually used as an ornament, and all these can tolerate down to about 15 degrees and make nice specimen plants in containers. And then you could also plant, there's a lot of plants that are normally grown in the ground that you could put in containers. You can grow, you can grow just about any plant in a container that you could plant out in the ground as long as you give it enough care,
mm-hmm.
which means you have to be there to water it quite regularly through the summer and repotting it every 2 or 3 years,
mm-hmm.
and pruning it.
A little more challenging.
Yeah.
What on earth is the raisin tree? Vinia dulcis?
Yeah, it's actually quite an interesting plant. It's a beautiful tree.
Mm-hmm.
No stunning flowers, but just the foliage looks nice, has a really nice shape, gets to be quite a large tree. And the fruit is probably the most interesting fruit of all the ones in the book because the fruit is actually pea-sized, and you don't eat the fruit. What you eat is the stem that the fruit's attached to
uh-huh.
swells up and becomes... becomes sort of gnarly. If you translate, it's a tree from China, and the translation of the name is chicken claw pear.
It does look like that.
So if you let the stem actually get totally ripe, and you eat it, it tastes sort of like pear. To me, it tastes more like candy walnuts.
Mm-hmm.
The one caution with this tree, first of all, sometimes you have to cut off whole branches to get at the stems.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is to really wait until they're dead ripe. Where they're ripe, they taste just like stems.
Sort of like the persimmon, huh?
Yeah. But it is it's really a nice tree. You know, if you have if you just want a nice big tree out in the landscape somewhere, and this would also be, for a nice nibble here and there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I shouldn't say all the fruits in the book are not just for a little nibble here and there. Some of the ones really you can fill your larder with.
Right.
Lee, you mentioned the good old May Popper, the passion vine, which I don't think fruits here, but sounds like an intriguing plant where it does.
Oh, actually, it should fruit there because I fruited it up here even.
Okay.
And the one thing is that it has some pollination quirks. First of all, you need two plants to get fruit. And it could be that if you see like a thicket of plants, they could all be the same clone since they spread underground. So you need two different clones. The other thing is when the fruit gets ripe, first of all, the fruit's hard to see because it's the same color as the foliage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also the fruit drops when it's ripe.
Okay.
But if you do eat it, it is one of my favorite fruits. It tastes virtually identical to the tropical passion fruit, which it's obviously closely related to.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody isn't familiar with that taste, it's the main flavor in Hawaiian punch. But I think it's delectable.
So just if you want to try to get the fruit, just make sure that you've got two different plants so that there's cross-pollination.
And also, you might want to help along with a little hand pollination.
Okay. So the medlar seems to be getting a little more press time, if you will.
Oh, that's a great one because a lot of people have small yards.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in small yard especially, people have to have this choice to make whether ornamental or fruiting plant. Medlar is a beautiful fruiting plant. It has, first of all, it's a tree that gets only about 8 feet high, maybe 6 feet wide. And in the spring, it opens up these white, relatively large for a fruit tree, large white blossoms that look very much like wild roses.
Mm-hmm.
The foliage looks nice.
Mm-hmm.
And the tree itself has a nice shape. And then the fruit is first of all, you only need one tree. It does not need cross-pollination.
So good for small places.
Yeah. And then you harvest it in the fall.
Uh-huh.
It has a little quirk also in that it's when you harvest it, you can't eat it right away. It has to soften. Sort of like a pear or an avocado or a banana.
Which is great, because you'll be busy eating some of your other fruits, so save that one for later, right?
But it's quite unique. It has a flavor of like a very rich applesauce with a little wine added and a little spice. And it was actually quite a popular fruit in Europe, where it's from, up to maybe a couple hundred years ago.
Mm-hmm. So I'm suspecting that the kiwi has some quirks, too, because Bob and I have talked about trying to grow the vine and never being able to get any fruit.
Oh.
Give us some tips on the kiwi.
Please.
It's the hardy kiwi.
The hardy kiwi, yes, sir.
The hardy kiwi is, as testimonial to how beautiful it is, it was grown and it was introduced in this country a little over 100 years ago, and it was grown for almost all that time strictly as an ornamental. You go to any old estate or public garden, and they all had hardy kiwi vines just as ornamentals.
Mm-hmm.
The fruit is not all that obvious, so a lot of people, I always imagine how many people walked under these beautiful vines and pergolas and things like that, admiring them and not realizing these really tasty fruits under there. The fruit, quickly, is obviously related to the market kiwi, except it's small, has a smooth skin, so it's edible in total, just like a grape, and the flavor's better. It's sweeter and more aromatic.
Okay, so how do I get fruit?
So to get fruit, first of all, there's two different species that are commonly grown for fruiting, Actinidia colomicta, Actinidia arguta.
Right.
They differ in when they ripen and how vigorous they are. First of all, they're very vigorous vines, so they do need some sort of structure generally to support them. And they have separate male and female plants. So to start out with, you have to have a male.
There it goes.
For one or more females.
Okay.
And then you just have to, basically, if you do that, they bear very similar to grapes and sort of prune very similarly. And basically, it's the male and the female and time.
Okay.
Just waiting for them to get old enough. The Actinidia arguta often takes you know, 5 to 8 years to begin bearing.
Okay. Oh.
The other one, the Actinidia columicta, often bears a year after it's planted.
Okay.
Which one's got the beautiful variegated vine, or both of them?
Right, that's what I'm going to say. The Actinidia columicta, the one that bears quicker and is not as vigorous growing, the male plants have the most beautiful foliage that you can imagine.
I've seen
it. Green with little silvery colors, and then the
and
silver
reds.
Grades into pink. Generally, I don't like variegated foliage on plants, but this is one of the most prettiest foliage of any plant.
So, Lee, then, most of those are, that's the indication then, and most of what people have are the males, if they're getting it for that showy foliage,
right? Oh, yeah.
So, if she's all green, we know she's a female, and if she's colorful, we know it's a male.
Generally, I mean, different clones are expressed differently, and the females do sometimes get a little color also.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you buy them, you know, any good nursery should specify this is a male, this is a female.
All right.
I'm going to try again now.
So what's your favorite landscape fruit before we go?
Geez, that's hard to say. That reminds me of when I was little and I used to watch Davy Crockett.
Yeah.
And he was at a county fair and he's holding two pieces of pie in the hand. One's like a blueberry pie, one's an apple pie. And he asks him which one's his favorite. He's supposed to judge which is the best. Takes a bite of one. He says, whenever I take the bite of one, seems like it's the best fruit.
Uh-huh.
I mean, best pie.
Uh-huh.
So it's similar with me. Among my favorite landscape fruits, definitely blueberries, pawpaws, American persimmon, and this would be named varieties, not wild ones.
Right.
The kiwi fruit is definitely up there with the best. I guess those would be my all-time favorite. Oh, and another one, which is a very rare one, is called Shipova.
Uh-huh.
It's a hybrid of a plant that's related to mountain ash and pear, and it just has this, it's very pear-like in its taste, but it has this other quality too, and it also has this really nice meaty texture.
Uh-huh.
So to me, it's the ideal thing for a fall day. You pick a few, you put them in your pocket as you walk along, you just munch on them.
Sounds good. Okay, that one I'm going to have to, that one I don't have, so that one we'll add to the plan this year. Thanks, Lee. We appreciate your time.
Okay, well, thanks. Anytime.
Lee Reich is the author of Landscaping with Fruit, A Homeowner's Guide, published by Story Press. He spoke to us from his home in New Paltz, New York. Of course, for more information on Lee's work and his garden, please see our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin Word of the Week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Well, Miss Wishy, continuing our all-fruit extravaganza here, we've got a couple fruit-related questions.
Yes, we do, and welcome back to the show. How about if I start with one for you, Bob?
Please.
This one is from Lois Allen in Louisville. I'm writing about my Hale Haven peach tree, which is about 18 years old. It has been a good producer in years when we have had no late frost, but last year, one of the major branches died out. The fruit shriveled up in August and all the leaves fell off. Clear indication, right, that the branch died. The rest of the tree, you know, continued to grow fruit. This spring, Bob, another branch appears to be dead as well. It has no leaves. The smaller, higher branches are leafy now and have buds on them. She's wondering if her tree is done for or is there something I can do to save it?
I fear the Hale Haven is no longer hardy.
Yeah.
It happens to peach trees, and it's one limb at a time. I've lost peach trees like this, too. Peach trees can have so many problems with borers or different diseases or so forth, but if it's dying one major limb at a time, it's time to maybe take it off at the ground level and start over again. It's always kind of sad because they're great trees and kind of fun to have, but it just doesn't sound very good at all.
Yeah, if major parts are dying out, it's done for. It ain't coming back, as they say.
And then there's a question from Nancy Dean in Bardstown, a regular listener to the show. She says, this is a great question. I overwintered a fairly old but not large lemon tree in a big container on my sun porch at about 50 degrees. It now has lots of flower buds, the first time in years. Should I start to fertilize it now, or what should I use? I prefer to stay organic. I did fertilize last spring after Janine answered a similar question. So the heat's on you, kiddo. What should she do here?
I hope, but she can't remember what was said and what she used. Nancy, if you want to stay organic, it needs a little nitrogen, of course, because it's a woody plant, and it's in a container. So you can use bone meal and blood meal. Those are sort of your standards that give you a little extra nitrogen. Cottonseed meal, same thing, a little extra nitrogen, that sort of thing. But then the thing that I have learned from other people that grow the lemon tree thing, the citrus, you know, in Kentucky in containers, that in order to get good bloom and to make the fruits actually set, Bob, yep, they need magnesium. Because like a magnesium deficiency is what can kind of screw them all up. Yeah. One way in which to get magnesium is Epsom salts, okay, which is magnesium sulfate.
You're right.
So you can use a little Epsom salt sprinkled on the top. Make sure that it's not going to be right on like roots or anything, because yep, it'll, you know, be a desiccant. But a little Epsom salt right on the top, and when you water it in, it'll deliver little parts of magnesium.
And send us a picture of your lemons, please.
Yeah.
When Janine's advice comes.
Yeah, if
to
it bear works.
Fruit.
If in fact it works. I'm not a citrus expert by any means.
It will bear fruit, we promise.
All right. All right. Well, if you have a question, you can get a hold of us, right, Bob?
Visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246. Miss Wishy, I think we're getting fairly close to Easter.
We are,
with this particular Latin word of the week.
Uh-huh. In honor of Easter, the Latin word of the week this week is crux.
Which is cross.
Which means cross.
I never knew that.
Yeah. Okay, check this out. Yeah. This is a little bit of a different sort of, this is almost a hybrid Latin word of the week Bob plant story.
I'm all ears,
okay,
kid. Yep.
But I couldn't resist it. Okay,
no,
because
of not.
Because of this. Okay, yeah. Thus the cruciferous vegetable group. The cruciferous vegetable group, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, collard. Cruciferous,
yeah,
because the flowers of these vegetables are four-petaled and resemble a cross.
I did not know that.
Crazy, huh?
No, it's good.
More plant symbolism. Are you ready for this?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Plants have long been associated with Christianity, right? Mm-hmm. Mostly because people were illiterate, so it was way easier to... Yeah. Get the lessons across using symbolism and visual types of things.
Pictures.
So, of course, flowers. Perfect, right? Lily of the Valley. The lily, of course, is the flower of the Virgin Mary, symbolizing purity. It's white, right? And it blooms in the spring during Easter. It suggests the Immaculate Conception.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. If baby Jesus is offering a bouquet of lilies to a saint, mm-hmm, it reminds the viewer of the virtues of chastity.
Oh.
Okay. So there's little subtleties depending on who has the flower and what they're doing with it.
Yeah.
One of my favorite ones is the rosemary. Blue flowers were often equated, or associated rather, with Mary because of her blue cloak, right?
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. The blue iris represents Mary as the Queen of Heaven. The blue flowers of the herb rosemary. Haven't you ever seen that beautiful blue,
yeah,
of the rosemary blooms? Those are thought to have appeared on this Mediterranean plant after Mary hung her cloak on the rosemary bush.
I'm sure it happened.
How about that?
Yeah.
How do you think it got its name rosemary? Right?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
And it has a reputation, this particular herb, of remembrance. Okay.
Excellent.
Let's see. The dogwood has a slightly newer association with Christ. The red spots on the white petals are drops of blood. Check it out. The dogwoods are starting to bloom, everybody.
Yep.
Check it out. The four bracts resemble the cross.
There you go.
And the center resembles the crown of thorns. Legend has it as well, Bob, that the cross was made of dogwood wood.
Right,
and right, as a result, was cursed by God and thus never grew large again.
Uh-oh.
How about that?
Boy, he can hold a thought, can he?
Yep.
Hold a grudge, actually.
All right, one last one. In the New World, when the Spanish missionaries came trying to convert Caribbean people to Christianity, right? They used plants to teach about Christ's crucifixion. Apparently, the passion flower, this tropical, right?
Yep.
Inspired such a story, you know, its shape similar to the dogwood, and that's why it became known as the passion flower, too. The flower has five wounds, like, ooh, the five wounds that Christ,
yeah,
had. The spiraled style in the center represent the lashes he endured. The pistil represents the pillar of scourge. The radial filaments represent his crown of thorns. The five sepals represent his five wounds, and it goes on. Just look at the passion flower, and it's true. It's crazy.
That's beyond anything I knew before.
Exactly. So there you have it. Have a nice Easter.
There
is some symbolism definitely in plants that you can refer to if you are so inspired. But crux equals cross in Latin.
As in the crucifix.
Indeed.
Yep.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, from hatchery to home coop, we're going to be raising baby chicks. You won't want to miss this one.
Homegrown is produced by the always quick with the yolk, Brad Yost, in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.